Good grief. Question everything.
Welcome. You're listening to Why, a Good Grief Network podcast with Amy Lewis Rowe and Laura Schmidt.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Why, a Good Grief Network podcast.
This week, we'd like to give a special thanks to Leah and Brendel for their support.
And we'd like to take a minute and thank our patrons. If you would like to become a patron, we'll put a link in our show notes and you can check it out. But right now we have Brooke and the Story family, Serena, Mary, Kindy, and Laura. So thank you for supporting our work, and we look forward to building this network together.
We honestly couldn't do it without you, so thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Today's question comes from Brooke in Michigan. Brooke asks, what do you do when you feel as if you're drowning in your own grief? What steps can you take to get back into activism? That's a great question.
Well, I'll take a stab at this. Thank you, Brooke, for reaching out. I wrote a blog post, and it's about how individual grief coincides or helps or can prevent work on the collective level. My heart is really heavy right now. Back in August, one of my childhood friends passed away. Shortly after that, my little sister had to put her beloved dog down. This dog was one of the best beings that I've ever encountered. Just about a month ago, I had to put down my cat, who has been in my life for 18 years. That was heartbreaking as well. And then just today, my other sister and her family have to put down their family dog. And he has been around longer than their kids have, so that's really hard on the kids. So I'm experiencing a lot of individual grief right now. And in this blog that I'm talking about, and we'll post to the show notes, trying to say that what we need to do is take care of our individual grief before we can really honestly take a look at collective grief. If we're not doing our own work, it's easy to fall into that despair, to fall into that baggage and grief and anger and just heavy emotions in general. They take a lot of energy from us. Once we look at the problems we're facing and the grief that we're facing, and we can breathe through them and let ourselves know, give ourselves permission to feel the pain, not to linger in the pain, but to feel it and to let it course through our body and to breathe out. And to breathe out love and compassion, then that helps us deal with our individual pain. And then eventually we become ready for looking at collective problems and collective pain. And we need to do it soon. And I end my blog post by saying this is the start of a revolution. You know, getting in touch with ourselves and working through that grief on an individual basis allows us to be freer to look at collective problems.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think that looking at how we define the word activism is going to be key here, because how do you think about activism when you're drowning in your own grief? Because when you're drowning in your own grief, you just are trying to stay afloat. It's very hard to think about other people because you're doing all you can to survive. And this is where redefining what it means to be an activist would be helpful. For me, being an activist is challenging the status quo for what you believe is right, standing up for truth, even when it's not popular.
So I'm curious to know how you can be an activist and advocate for truth, even while it's unpopular, while you're drowning in your own grief.
That's where I think authenticity comes in. And I know we've mentioned Brené Brown before, but she writes a lot about this. And I think showing up and saying that you're not in a place to deal with collective grief is an act of activism. It's countercultural. We have these ideas of everything we should be able to do, and we often think of our human limitations as something that gets in the way, when instead they can be tools to help us connect and reach people who might not otherwise be able to listen. They might not be able to hear you talk about climate change, but when they hear you talk about personal grief that is getting in the way of you doing something that you believe in and that you want to be doing, they might be able to relate to that. And therefore, that might hook them in, may develop a friendship, may open them to a conversation they wouldn't otherwise be open to. I think we have to meet at the level of shared humanity before we can actually change minds.
Which tools do we employ in our daily lives when we feel like we're drowning?
Yeah, so for me, the easiest one is music. because music speaks to my heart and my gut. It can also speak to my brain, but I can also kind of zone out and just feel the music rather than think about it. And so regardless of what kind of mood I'm in, I can turn music on. And if it's music that strikes me as heartfelt and true, chances are it's going to help me return to a state of thinking about something bigger than me. It's going to distract me from wallowing and at the same time invite me into exploring how this beautifully sad song turned into something healing from an experience that the artist likely felt that was not healing or beautiful. They've made something beautiful out of the ugly. And to me, art is activism, or I guess can be. I almost wonder if it should be. But then, of course, the word should comes with expectations, and I overthink a lot. But I think good art speaks to truth. And I think, isn't the goal of activism truth and justice?
Yeah, it's a good point. Art brings up something that's universal within humanity, right? I mean, and different art speaks to me than the art that Amy likes, but if you find the kind of art that moves you, does it not show that we're connected by something? And you're right, I mean, it reaches towards some sort of truth or some sort of connection that we all share, otherwise it wouldn't move us.
Right.
Like a good piece of art, whether it's music or a movie or a poem or, an image drawn by somebody or painted by somebody, whatever art you appreciate, the artist felt something or was moved by something in order to create it. And that's why we hold it up as being a good example of art.
Yes. And speaking of that, it reminds me that creativity in itself is often a remedy for the drowning in my despair. That being said, when I am drowning in despair or in a depression of some sort, I don't feel the urge to create. And so some compromises I've learned are if I can pick something easy, like coloring, where the picture's already there, all I have to do is pick the colors, that can be helpful. It's a nice distraction because, well, I'll backtrack. I also, in addition to coloring, sometimes like to sketch very simple objects. I'm not that good at sketching. I'm by no means a professional. But occasionally I'll sketch the mug in front of me or my cell phone or some common object. And the beauty of it being a common object is I don't expect to create a piece of art that I'm going to want to frame or needs to be good. It's really about just helping me get into a type of headspace, a creative concentration, if you will. And I believe that creative concentration helps reduce the feeling of drowning. It helps me feel connected to other people who create through art, etc.
Well, and does it not force you to look at something that you've seen a million times, but it forces you to look in a different way?
It reminds me of The Summer Day, a Mary Oliver poem, where she says, "I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention."
Here's another quote by Mary Oliver. She says, "Instructions for living a life. Pay attention, be astonished, tell about it." And I think all three of those things help us when we're feeling overwhelming despair. Getting natural or making time to get into a park or go for a hike, surround yourself with animals, anything that we sort of perceive as other or more natural than sitting in a circle with human beings and bouncing ideas. You know, if you can put your feet on some grass or some dirt, if you can walk along some rocks and see the river, listen to the river, be with the river. If you can try to interact with your dog and figure out what the heck your dog's thinking, you know, all of these also force your brain into a different mode of thinking. It forces us to change our perspective and to get outside of our normal day-to-day routine. Another tool that we implement, and this is really popular with therapists and anybody who's experienced any recovery work, is making a gratitude list. I know that Amy and I talk a lot about making gratitude lists just in our day-to-day lives. A gratitude list forces us to stop thinking with this reptilian part of our brain, the very ancient part of our brain, the fight, flight, or freeze part of our brain, and moves us into our neocortex, which is more forward thinking. It deals with abstract thought. It deals with planning for the future and things of that nature. So if you can sit down and construct 10 things that you're grateful for, just the act of doing that changes the way you're thinking. It changes the way that your brain responds.
And I'd also note that whenever gratitude lists come up, I also want to change the idea that gratitude lists are these kind of fluffy, everything's great kind of thing, because I've told this story before, but when I'm in a depression, I can't put a lot of things on the list, especially when it comes to human relationships, because I sit there and I'll think about the last argument I had with that person. I'll sit there and think about how I'm unworthy to be their friend, or depression just has a way of making everything distorted. I mean, it's part of what makes it an illness, right? Is it distorts reality. And so when I'm in that kind of a headspace where my truth is distorted, I can find real truth by picking small objects to put on my gratitude list. If I can say, I am grateful for this pen that I'm using to write this list, that doesn't conjure any sort of emotional response from me. The pen's pretty neutral. And I can genuinely feel grateful that I have this utensil that lets me put my thoughts into symbols on a page that I can then later understand when I look back at.
That's a pretty powerful statement.
Why, thank you.
Well, I mean, we don't take enough time to understand that even writing is a symbol. You know, it's not a concrete thing. We teach each other how to communicate through these symbols. And once we learn them, once we learn the alphabet, we don't really give a second thought to the fact that it's something that we've created. It's a construction.
Yeah, I mean, if you stop and think about it, to me, it's a miracle that I can put symbols on a page and use that to show you what is happening in my personal brain that no one else has access to. It's my way to try to give you a glimpse into what's going on in my brain using symbols that I didn't create, that have already been created. I don't think we take enough time to appreciate literacy and the miracle that it is.
Well, and it seems like art, right? Literacy is art, the ability to communicate. And people know that reading poems, or rather writing poems and writing books or essays, we know that that's art. But to take a step back and realize how brilliant it is that we're able to communicate like this, and the rapid speed by which we communicate with the internet. Steve Rogenbuchs says something like, and I can write something on the internet and drastically change how someone's feeling across the world. We can do that. We have the capability to communicate on a global level, and that has created some problems. But also, let's take a step back. Let's take a second and realize what a beautiful opportunity and tool it is that we can now communicate worldwide.
Absolutely.
A final tool that I want to share in response to Brooke's question today is moving your body. We take that for granted a lot. I take it for granted a lot, especially since I spent the last 3 years sitting at a desk and doing a lot of work digitally on a computer. I also want to give props to Amy. She recently graduated with her yoga certification and is now working for the local YMCA, teaching 5 classes a week. So going from nothing to going into an intensive program, learning yoga and how to teach yoga, and now just without any, or rather without much prior experience, you're going right in teaching 5 classes a week. And just recently, Amy was talking to me about how she felt overwhelmed, but the fact that she feels like she's helping people and that yoga is becoming purposeful for her seems like it's a useful way to spend some time and energy.
Absolutely. I've been paying more attention to my own movement as I try to plan classes that help other people pay attention to their body moving. We don't pay attention to this shell that we live in. We don't sit there and think about how remarkable it is that we can move in all these strange yoga poses. Yoga is really about paying attention to your body and checking in. And as an instructor, I'm not doing yoga while my students do it. I may demonstrate things, but for the most part, it's my job to be present for them, and yoga poses are designed to have your full attention. When you're in a balancing pose, you can't be thinking about your day because you will fall. And it's really amazing that I can try to guide people through that and yet still feel the benefits of it, even if I'm not actively practicing that balance pose.
We can use our bodies as tools to help move the energy and to help move the feelings through us. Sleeping swan is a hip opener, and we tend to store a lot of our emotions in our hips. For me, it's incredibly fascinating. You open your hips, you do a stretch, and sometimes you feel overwhelming feelings that you need to process. We've also been talking about Bessel van der Kolk's book, The Body Keeps Score, and how we don't have very many opportunities as human animals to give our bodies the space to release the stored trauma that we have. I'm interested in moving our bodies and using our bodies as tools for healing and for generating emotional responses so they're not just buried deep within our tissues. You know, people hear all the time like, oh yeah, my shoulders are so tight because I carry a lot of weight on my shoulders. And that doesn't have to be physical weight, right? You keep a lot of your trauma, a lot of your emotions, a lot of your frustrations in your body. So if you can move your body, and whether that's through things like yoga or Pilates or going for a run or just stretching, dancing is a wonderful tool. And dancing, unless you're good at it, it stops people in their tracks. And recently, Amy told me that she wants me to dance more because I'm not a dancer. I don't really like it. I think I look funny because I do when I dance. But what's fun is now I'll just do weird dances around the house constantly. And it helps, right? Moving your body not only reminds you that you're alive and you have a body to move, but it also helps release a lot of the tension that you're carrying around with you.
When I teach hip openers in my yoga class, I remind people that, one, these strong emotions may come up, but also if they do, that they're not alone and that we can breathe through anything. And I think we lose sight of that.
We can breathe through anything. Joanna Macy, in her work That Reconnects, recommends a process called breathing through. And this is where you breathe in all of the pain of the world. You breathe in all of your individual pain. And you breathe in deep, you fill your lungs with that. And then on your exhale, on your out breath, you focus on love and compassion. And that very act not only helps move some of the grief, whether it's your individual or the collective grief, but it helps you focus on love and compassion. It helps you focus on what you want the world to be instead of what you feel like the world is right now. So the elephant in the room or this conversation is the differentiation between mental health and just grief in general. And what I want to ask, Amy, and maybe you can help me explore this, is does looking into these systemic problems, you know, whether it's climate change or genocide or mass violence or these school shootings that keep happening, if we look hard enough, does that create mental health problems?
That's a great question, and I think that's often what people are afraid of and why many people are afraid to think about these things. And I can't deny there seems to be some correlation. Most of the people I know who do talk about these things and think about these things have had some mental illness challenges in their life at some point, but I don't think looking at the issues causes the mental illness. I think mental illness often forces people to see life in a new way. It challenges perception. If your brain is sick and you can't trust what it's telling you, it forces you to dig deeper into what is truth. And I think that naturally leads to people being concerned about these issues because they can't turn away, because it is true. These things are happening. You can be in denial about that. And if your life is going as planned, maybe you can stay in denial about that. But the truth of the matter is the systems are failing most of us. And as soon as you realize the system is not serving you, I don't know. I mean, what do you do?
That's a good question. Well, I like your idea that looking into these systemic issues doesn't necessarily cause mental health troubles, but maybe it's the opposite, where you have some sort of mental health troubles and it becomes a door through which to see these problems. There's a great quote that it makes me think of, and I'm going to share it with you guys. It says, "The doors to the world of the wild self are few but precious. If you have a deep scar, that is a door. If you have an old, old story, that is a door. If you love the sky and the water so much you almost cannot bear it, that is a door. If you yearn for a deeper life, a full life, a sane life, that is a door." And that is by Clarissa Pinkola Estes. She wrote an article that argues that we're made for these times, and I'll include that in the show notes as well. But it reminds me, and I think it's incredibly true, that all of these are doors, right? So maybe mental health and the being forced to question what's true, that's a door, right? And falling in love with the world, that's a door into looking into these systemic issues. And as she asserts, the doors are few, but they're precious. And it's because they break down these constructions that we're forced to fit in or that we walk around with. In this world, we walk around with several unquestioned assumptions. And I think that these doors literally open up a pathway to look at these assumptions and make us question them and see what the validity of them are. And so, yes, mental health might be a door. And with it has a lot of things that make life tougher. It becomes a door for some, if you're willing to look, right? Because you can have mental health problems and choose not to look at any of these systemic issues. And we know a lot of people out there that are like that. But you can use mental health as a tool. The problem is, right, that, and I think I've experienced this and I wrote a little bit about it in my thesis work, but if you have a predisposition for mental health issues, depression, things of that nature, you have to work harder for self-care, especially in a world where you're constantly inundated by bad news. And so I really respect your question, Brooke, because I think the tools that Amy and I have been talking about through this entire episode, they not only help people who are experiencing grief, but they're also tools for people who are experiencing depression. And again, they don't have to be the same thing. They can overlap. They don't have to. But I think the question fits for both, whether it's depression or just this overwhelming grief. And I think that if you don't tend to your overwhelming grief, it can easily turn into depression.
Definitely. I'm thinking of some of the activists, the older activists we know, that seem like they have a real chip on their shoulder and like they're angry at everyone. And with everything going on, you can understand why. There's a lot to be angry about. And yet, how do we not let that anger transform us into an activist that may turn more people away than we invite in?
What is our intention with activism? And are we doing it because our body and soul tell us we need to be doing it? Are we doing it because we want to convince other people? Are we doing it because we're so angry with the system that we want to overturn it at any moment? You know, and in the process of answering these questions, who are we ostracizing? Who are we leaving out? Who are we including? Who are we inviting in?
Yeah, certainly, because I also think about the idea that you can't invite everyone in. Just by being myself, I will turn some people away. And I used to want to change and try to have everyone like me, but it's just not possible. And so for me, again, it comes down to intention. Am I speaking my truth to be right? Or am I speaking it because I believe that it will stand alone as truth? Recently, someone on Facebook wrote something about how they think of calling someone out for saying something racist or sexist or homophobic doesn't have to be shameful as long as that person wasn't doing so to intentionally be cruel. They said they like to think about it as telling someone that they have spinach in their teeth. It's the polite thing to do. You're doing it because you care and you don't want them to walk around with that spinach in their teeth to everyone they know. You're doing them a favor. And if we could try to reduce some of the shame that comes around with being called out and look at it as a step we're taking as a society to hold each other accountable in service of truth and justice, that can completely change how we're looking at these things.
I mean, what you're talking about is integrity, right?
Yeah.
And I'm interested to continue to explore these sorts of questions with regard to truth and activism. And, you know, we're 4 episodes into this podcast, and what amazes me is I'm constantly left with the question of what is truth? How do we know truth? Even with just you and me sitting here and talking into this microphone, I'm constantly like, well, we're talking about truth as if it's this tangible thing, that if it's this absolute thing that maybe we can wrap our hands around, and maybe it is, maybe it's not, I'm not sure, but we're going to keep exploring it. We're going to keep asking what it is and how to access truth, what it means to be alive in this time and place. Is this truth different than truth 100 years ago? Does truth change with facts?
Yeah, those are all great questions. And I'm also thinking about how to be committed to truth, we have to accept that our perception is flawed. Our perception is formed by our 5 senses. We've been watching Brain Games lately, and they're really great at showing the gaps in our perception. I also am thinking of Terence Hayes' Lighthead poem. This is an excerpt from Terence Hayes' poem, Lighthead's Guide to the Galaxy. The small dog barking at the darkness has something to say about the way we live. I'd rather have what my daddy calls scrimp. He says discreet and means the street, just out of sight. Not what you see, but what you perceive. That's poetry. Not the noise, but its rhythm, an arrangement of derangements. I'll eat you to live. That's poetry.
So, Amy, tell us why you just read that confusing-ass poem.
For me, I don't think you can get to truth or be committed to truth if you're not willing to acknowledge your own perception is distorted. By acknowledging our perception is flawed, it connects us in our humanity, and it gives us permission to be wrong. And that permission to be wrong is something we lose sight of, and that's where pride and ego often get in the way of truth. What I'm now beginning to understand is that Hayes is referring to perception is where art comes from, perception is where poetry comes from, and I'll eat you to live, that's poetry. I'll eat you to live is an unpleasant fact that, God forbid, anyone finds themselves in an actual situation where they have to do that, but it's true that we have this life force, this desire to survive that will make us go to crazy extremes that we might not even be able to imagine unless we're actually in that situation. And he's saying that's poetry, like being able to look at those dark truths in ourselves where we don't behave in the way we deem morally acceptable, that's poetry too. And for me, it's honoring perception and its flaws and saying that it's enough and it's beautiful and we don't need perfection.
So
Brooke asks, what do you do when you feel as if you're drowning in your own grief? What steps can you take to get back into activism?
Brooke, might we encourage you to make a gratitude list, to create some art, to create anything, to move your body, to get in the natural world, or hang out with some animals? Maybe you can search for awe and beauty. If you're searching for it, you don't have to look too far. You can find little miracles everywhere. The will of life seems to be incredibly resilient. And whenever I see a flower growing up through the cracks, it's just a reminder of how beautiful this world is. And those, Brooke, are my recommendations for how to overcome seemingly overwhelming grief and get back into activism.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. We shared some of our tools for how we deal with paralyzing grief about these issues or paralyzing personal grief that may get in the way of us looking at these issues. We'd love to hear some of your thoughts and tools. You can comment on Facebook. You can contact us at goodgriever@gmail.com. You can comment on our website below this podcast.
Thank you for listening to Why, a Good Grief Network podcast with your hosts, Amy Lewis-Rowe and Laura Schmidt. If you like what you hear, consider subscribing, commenting, leaving feedback, or just checking out our Patreon page. We'll come back at you next week with some more information and some more big questions. Thank you for listening.